Good afternoon, and thanks everyone for joining on today's call, Diversifying Funding at Your SIL, a discussion. And it's going to be facilitated by Phil Pangrazio and Dennis Fitzgibbons. We're really lucky to have them with us today, and I'm really excited about it. If you need access to CART for today's call, please go to the April website at www.april-rural.org, and you can follow that link right on our homepage. If you're having any trouble accessing it, please email me at mary.olson, O-L-S-O-N, at mso.umt.edu, and I can send you that link. Today's call will be recorded, and that audio recording and the transcript are going to be available online at our website under that IL Conversations tab following the call. During today's conversation, if you would like to add to the topic from your experience or ask questions, and we really encourage you to do that. We're hoping that today is a really big, great conversation. And in order to join it, you can press *2 on your phone to raise your hand, and then I can make your line live. When I unmute your line, the moderator will state your line has been unmuted. Once your question's been answered or you've made your comments, if you press *2 again, it will lower your hand, and that way I won't keep calling on you. When I unmute your line, the moderator is going to say your line has been unmuted. You may also type your questions into the CART chat box, and I can voice those for you. Please remember to evaluate our conversations on our website following the call under the IL Conversations tab. Your feedback's really important to us, and it can only make us stronger. This IL Conversation is presented by the IL Net, which is operated by the Independent Living Research Utilization Program, or ILRU, in partnership with NICL, April, and Utah State. Support for this IL Conversation is provided by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services Administration for Community Living. No official endorsement of the Department of Health and Human Services should be inferred. And without further ado, I'm going to introduce you to our facilitators for today. Phil Pangrazio has been the president and CEO of the Ability 360 since 2000. Ability 360 is one of the largest centers for independent living serving people with disabilities in the U.S. with a budget of $43.5 million. Wow! Pangrazio oversaw the planning and construction of the Disability Empowerment Center, now called the Ability 360 Center, that opened in 2008, and also led a fundraising effort to raise $12.5 million to build the Ability 360 Sports and Fitness Center that opened in October of 2011. Phil served for 10 years as a board member of the National Council on Independent Living, a person with quadriplegia and a wheelchair user for over 38 years, and Phil has lived in Arizona since 1981. And we also have with us Dennis Fitzgibbons. He's worked in independent living for over 27 years, first in Massachusetts and then in Maine, as the executive director of Alpha One. He's now happily retired, but we were able to hook him in for today's call. We're really lucky for that. So again, thanks for joining us and for leading this call. Without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to you, Phil.
Great. Well, thanks, Mary. And welcome, everybody. Good afternoon. I'm just going to kick it off kind of quickly, and then I'm going to turn it over to Dennis. But just wanted to start by saying, you know, when Mary asked the two of us to, you know, to do this teleconference, you know, we both of us, neither one of us, kind of felt like we're certainly not the complete experts on this subject, and we don't claim to be. We thought it would be great to kind of have a conversation, throw out some of our experiences with, you know, fee-for-service contracting, trying to diversify our funds. Dennis will tell you, as long as you're involved at a Center for Independent Living, your board of directors is always pushing you, diversify your funds, we have to diversify our funds. And it's kind of a constant mantra in IL that we hear all the time. It's a lot easier to say than to do. And there's a lot of different ways that SILs can diversify their funds. They don't all have to be fee-for-service type contracts. There's other kind of funding sources that you can consider pursuing, and we'll talk about some of them later this afternoon. But we want to have this as interactive as possible. So, you know, please ask us questions. You can interrupt us and do that at any time during the session. And we want to hear some of your ideas too. So if you've done some things that are really innovative, that we haven't even brought up or discussed, we'd like to hear that, because I think, you know, we want everybody on the line to learn from what we're talking about today. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dennis to kind of go over some of what he's planned to talk about, and then I'll come back and share more of some of the things that we've done at Ability 360. So with that, Dennis, take it away.
All right. Thank you, Phil. Hi, everybody. It's always a pleasure to talk to colleagues and from other SILs around the country. And, you know, as Phil said, we're looking forward to hearing from you and your ideas. And as Phil and I were discussing about what we would talk about and how we want to approach this, and one of the things that did come up is that there's a real difference out there in terms of what each of us deals with from our perspective of where we're located, how big our SIL is, and many, many other factors. In fact, I was at a conference a few years ago, and I heard a colleague say, if you've seen one SIL, and I expected that would be finished with, you've seen them all. But in fact, the person said, if you've seen one SIL, you've seen one SIL. And, you know, it took me a little bit by surprise, because I'd expected to hear the other thing. But after considering it and really thinking about all the people I've met from the various SILs around the country, I have to be in complete agreement on that. There's, you know, we have core services in common, we have a common philosophy, but as organizations, we differ in so many other ways. And, you know, I've always been in awe of Phil and Ability 360 since I first learned of him and his efforts and the SILs efforts there in Arizona, and had the pleasure of visiting there several years ago. But Phil was gracious and turned away my praise and said, well, you know, we've always admired what Alpha One has accomplished as well. And he pointed out some of the differences that we encounter in our different states. And it really was a strong learning I took from that encounter, because it made me reflect on just what we all deal with individually. And a good example would be that, you know, Maine as a state, our entire population is 1.2 million. And we're the only Center for Independent Living here in Maine. In Arizona, I believe the population of the state is approximately 7 million. And I don't know how many SILs there are, but I know there's more than one. And just some other factors that are different for Maine, you know, we are now the oldest state in the nation, and the median age is higher than any other state. We are 96% white, so we don't have a lot of diversity of population. And we have a high level of poverty, we have a high level of disability, and we're mostly a rural state. We have some interesting things that impact the way we provide services, how we offer services, how we interact with the community that present us with challenges that way. But I'm sure each and every one of you has your own challenges that are different in many other ways. And we can talk about why you may want to diversify. And I think if you're on this call, you already probably do want to diversify. And as Phil said, there are a variety of ways that SILs have diversified their funding and their organization. And as I was planning for this discussion, and I was thinking, you know, what are the ways that we diversified over and above that pressure that Phil mentioned from the board of directors saying diversify, diversify, diversify? You know, one of the things we've struggled with in a state that is so white is reaching out to people of other of minority groups and youth and others. And so an effort at diversification that came about incidentally through a program has really helped us broaden our reach to younger people, to young people of color, and to really start to think more of serving minority groups here in the state, even though they're small. So there are lots of ways of looking at diversification in addition to the diversification of funding. And some things will work for you and some things won't work for you, because some things have worked for us here in Maine and some things haven't worked so well. We're known for developing fee-based programming, but we've taken stabs at other things, probably not to the degree that some of you have, but there's that constant need and pressure to make sure that if you lose any kind of funding, that there's a cut of any kind, it's not going to be a deathly blow, and you'll survive because you have a broad base of funding. So with that, I'm going to throw it back to Phil, because I'd like him to fill in some of the blanks on demographics and things that they deal with from their perspective at Ability 360.
Okay. Thanks, Dennison. You make a really good point about the fact that, you know, depending on where your center is located, you know, that's going to impact, you know, what really is possible. The things that we've done here at Ability 360, you know, being the center that is serving the greater Phoenix metropolitan area, you know, we're the fifth, we just passed Detroit. We're now the fifth largest city in the United States. We were number six for a long time. And, but if you include the greater metropolitan area, we're even much, much larger than that, because you mentioned the population of the state. You know, Maricopa County, which is, you know, the greater Phoenix area, is about, you know, it's pushing close to 5.5 million or so. So there's a lot of, you know, population base, which means there's a lot of resources to some extent in the valley. And it gives us a lot to draw from, both from the governmental side, the various city governments, the state, and then even private corporations. Although one thing about Arizona is that we really are not a corporate hub. There's, you know, the big multinational corporations, a lot of them are in other cities across the country and not really here in Phoenix. There are some, a few, but that's a challenge for us, wherein some of you who are in other cities, you know, Chicago is a good example. I know Access Living probably has a lot more corporate kinds of support because of, you know, all of the various, you know, corporations that are in Chicago. And other cities are like that too. But again, you know, what is possible really does depend upon where your center is. And a lot of you, you know, are from rural communities. And we know here in Arizona, because we have a lot of the state that is rural too. Dennis mentioned how many centers there are in Arizona. And there are five centers here. There's one in Tucson, one up in Prescott Valley, one in Yuma, Arizona. Tucson's pretty urban, but Yuma is not. And although it's a growing city, the Prescott Valley, northern Arizona area is very rural, as is Assist, which is up on the Navajo Reservation. So, you know, we have, you know, the challenges that those centers have in the rural communities, accessing various funders and resources, vastly different than what we, you know, we experience here in greater Phoenix. So, you know, it's always kind of tough to talk about, you know, the various things we do and then try to suggest, well, you know, you can do that too. If you're a center in a big city, maybe you can. If you're a center in a smaller community, in a rural community, you're going to have to be thinking about other creative ways to diversify your funding. I know that the center up in Prescott Valley has a large transportation program, and they've collaborated with the State Department of Transportation to be like the transportation provider in northern Arizona. And they've got like 10 vans, and they've got 10 drivers, and they get paid fee for service for that whole. They're taking people to the doctor and taking folks to and from various, you know, whether it's some of the group home operators or adult-based center operators and any type of transportation need that might arise in northern Arizona. They're doing that. So that was a pretty creative avenue for them to diversify some of their funding. And they've also developed a really nice partnership with their veterans community up at New Horizons because they have a lot of veterans that live in the Prescott area. And they get a lot of volunteer work out of them, and I thought that was really creative for them to do that. You know, everybody, you know, at Ability 360, kind of no secret, if you've followed what we've been doing over the years, you know, the biggest program that we have is the Personal Assistance Services program, and that has been our, you know, for lack of a better term, the bread and butter of the organization in terms of revenue. Mary mentioned, you know, my introduction about our budget being $43 million or something. And, you know, the vast majority of that is the personal assistance services. You know, and I've given presentations on that program in the past. And if any of you have an interest in it, I'm happy to share those PowerPoints with you. I'm not going to delve into that today because that would be, you know, it's really not the focus. It's though that is a excellent fee-for-service kind of program that, you know, I think any center might want to consider. I know philosophically sometimes centers struggle with becoming a quote-unquote provider of services like doing PAS because, you know, it is how it kind of there's a feeling of it potentially conflicts with the advocacy role that we all want to make sure that we have as our number one objective as a center. But we balanced it. We feel pretty good about it. We've done it well. We feel like we've been able to maintain kind of two sides of the house, our advocacy side and our personal assistance services program side. And actually, we kind of look at it in a way that program has generated surplus dollars that has allowed us to go out and hire more independent living advocates to do the advocacy work that we do in the community. So we kind of see it as complementary, but again, you know, we certainly understand that not all centers want to do personal assistance. But again, that information is available. The other thing that, you know, was mentioned in the bio is that we started the Sports and Fitness Center program, and you know that's another program that, again, it's not going to be something that every community is going to be able to develop and implement and fund. It's a mammoth financial commitment. It's something that we, after we built the Disability Empowerment Center, and we had an additional parcel of land and had an opportunity to go after funding to build the Sports and Fitness Center and co-located here on site at the Ability 360 Center, and we did a partnership with the City of Phoenix that we actually got included in the city bonds program and ultimately received $5.3 million from the City of Phoenix through city bonds to build the Sports and Fitness Center. And then that kind of kicked off our capital campaign, and then we pursued all the local foundations and other some private individuals that made up our $12.5 million capital campaign to build the sports center. So, you know, depending on what city you're in, I think some of the larger cities in the United States, I think, can pull that off. And some, we hear it all the time, some are pursuing it in various cities across the country because some folks really like the idea and they want to do it in their own communities, and we think that's kind of cool. But with that has come an opportunity to diversify some funding and pursue funding sources that, you know, we had never been able to pursue previously. We've, you know, and that kind of goes to the corporate side of funding, you know, where we've gone after, you know, the Arizona Coyote hockey program and the Arizona Cardinals football team. The whole range of private foundations that have, you know, done, that wanted to get on board and help support the Sports and Fitness Center, because the one thing about it is that there's no government funding for a Sports and Fitness Center program. So we've had to be really creative. Actually, one of our donors, our main individual donor that's been with us from the beginning, he funded the development director for us. So we actually paid, he's given us full amount of money to go out and hire a development person. So that individual has been, you know, work in the development community, and you know, we've had some pretty good success with it. We've had, you know, donations anywhere from $5,000, $10,000 to $10,000 to $20,000, in the $20,000 to $50,000 range, and some have been between $50,000 and $150,000. And more recently, last spring, we had an anonymous donor that contacted us, actually out of New York City, that heard about our program and made it, and then they sent their advisor, the person that kind of, you know, does the research for them, through Phoenix, and met with me, and they made an anonymous donation to the Sports and Fitness Center program for $250,000. And, you know, this just came out of the blue, but, you know, it was, the Sports Center was in its fifth year. It was gaining notoriety throughout the country. People were talking about it. And, you know, we're like, all right, that's great. We were excited that that was kind of, that our name was kind of out there and able to attract those kind of dollars. Some of the other things that we've done that I think fee-for-service-wise, you know, our home modification program. We started off, like many Centers for Independent Living, doing home modifications through CDBG-funded, the Community Development Block Grant funds through local city governments, and we had been doing that for probably 15 years. And because we had developed a relationship with the managed care organizations in our community, you know, we went to them and talked to them about, you know, doing home modifications for their members, because as many of you know, if you're on Medicaid, the CDBG funds don't cover folks who aren't Medicaid because Medicaid should cover it. And, but of course that was rarely happening, that folks on Medicaid were actually getting whole pods funded through that program. But we were successful getting some contracts with the MCOs, and now we've done, at our peak, we did about 300 home mods a year. We were that's kind of slowed a little bit over the last couple of years. Last year, we did about 160 home mods, and it generated around $700,000 of, and again, though that's not, that was the gross dollars of including the construction costs and everything. So it's not like we generated surplus dollars of $700,000. It didn't. In fact, the one thing about home mods, I don't see it as being a program that is, you're not doing it because it's going to add to your bottom line. You're doing it because you're going to create goodwill in the community amongst the disability community that you're fulfilling an important need in the community, and it gives you that credibility with the disability community. They're going to appreciate you doing that work, but again, it's not something that's going to add a lot of surplus dollars to your bottom line. And we've always kind of used some of our services that way, that we don't do it just because we want to generate extra, we want to generate surplus or from it. That we never kind of, viewed it that way. We really viewed it more that, if we're providing what people with disabilities need and want, then we feel good about it. And we think that's kind of, again, that gets into that whole issue of being, are you going to be a service provider? And I know some centers struggle with this. And whether it's personal assistance services or doing home mods, home mods is service provision. And you have to balance it. And, you've got to be okay with it, but also recognizing you need to fulfill your advocacy role and your mandate to the advocacy that's required of us. Maybe I should stop there for a second. Dennis, maybe you have a few, because I have some other things. I'll definitely come back and additional kinds of things we've done, but maybe Dennis, you have some thoughts based on what I just talked about, or even we could take some questions too.
Yeah. Well, I do have a few thoughts on what you said, Bill, and Diane, I think I have some questions as well. I just want to reiterate that even though there's some significant differences between us, for some reasons, in fact, personal assistance services has been the same kind of a boost for revenues at Alpha One, and has, excess revenues there have supported independent living services far and above what we could have done without it over many years. And as you talked about meeting community needs and building goodwill, I think sometimes diversification is not about generating more revenue, although you don't want to give it away because you lose money that way. But it's not going to generate the kind of revenue that's going to pay for additional services or supplement what you're already doing. But it is going to pay for itself, and I think that fits in many ways with us as well. Some of our oldest services that are in place, in fact, the oldest one is a driver evaluation program that can determine whether someone's able to drive a vehicle with or without adaptive equipment. And it's never been a big revenue generator, but there's nobody else in the state of Maine who can provide that service or who does provide that service. And it's made the difference for so many people over the years, been able to drive a vehicle and acquire a vehicle, so they've had greater independence in their lives. So, we made the investment in that program years ago. It's been difficult at times when the adaptive dam that we've had has either died or broken, and you've got that expense again, but we've seen that as a worthwhile investment of resources to continue to offer that service, because it used to be that the closest competitor was in New Hampshire, and now the closest competitor is in Massachusetts, and really an inconvenience for people to have to often go overnight to get a driver evaluation in another state. So it was something we were glad we were able to hang on to, because it met consumer needs. And I'd have to say also, in thinking about it, you know, many of the services we've had that have lasted the longest were the ones that were developed with as a direct response to consumer needs and saying, we want you guys to do this. We want you to develop these kind of services, which includes personal assistant services that we developed for the first time back in 1980. And they've grown significantly over the years, but that, again, was kicked off by consumers who had no resources to stay in the community unless someone developed something. And we took that on as a system change effort that then resulted in programming. But that was not our original intent. It was simply advocating for consumers who needed services at home in order to remain in their homes. So there's a lot of common ground here we have with our two centers, despite the differences. And, again, I won't dive into the personal assistance how-to either, but I'm happy to share the information in the future. I'll jump at one that we did back in the mid-80s, which was to create a for-profit subsidiary. And that met with some awkward looks and funny comments from some consumers, because there is something when you put for-profit in front of a business, people see that as taking advantage of people with disabilities. I don't really think that was the case. It's just how those businesses tend to operate, and that's how we wanted to compete in the community. And we also saw it as a way to generate those extra revenues to support independent living services. So in getting into DME sales in the mid-80s, paid many dividends for us that were not financial as well, because it really fit like a glove to our advocacy agenda, making sure people had the adaptive equipment or equipment they needed to be independent, and helping them find the money to pay for those things, either through Medicaid or other resources. Now, as the years progressed, that business became, instead of a profit center, it became more of a liability, and we did have to eventually close it down, because we're not in business to lose money on those things, but for many years it was worth having for not only revenue, but also because of the goodwill of the community and the goodwill and attention that it attracted from private businesses who, seeing us operate a business like that, I think it improved our credibility as an organization. And I can say for sure that we landed some significant demonstration grants as a result of having that business as well. So there are pluses and minuses all the time, and I think whether you get into fee-for-service or for-profit operations, or even the current things that you're doing, we all have to recognize that bad times can come to any aspect of the business, and sometimes you have to cut something loose and know when to stop and move on, so that you're not losing too much money. I don't think anything lasts forever, and that's that struggle around diversification, is making sure you do last, so you have that balance of funding. So I think the for-profit stuff, we've tried on more than one occasion with mixed results, and one of the things I'd throw out first on something like that, and that's true for any kind of fee-based program, but for a for-profit thing, I say the biggest mistake we made
Dennis?
We may have lost Dennis.
Oh, that's okay. Bummer. I was walking it, reconnected, and I do have a question from the chat room. We can go to that. And I wanted to remind folks again, if you've got specific questions for our speakers,
Or if you have an example you'd like to share of Secret Service we're doing, please press star 2, and that will raise your hand, and then I can get you in the queue and make you live. But first, I do have a question from the chat room. It's, do you all have any ideas about funding or Secret Services in smaller cells and primarily rural areas? So if you're somebody who's just getting started with a smaller sill, you know, do you have any thoughts or have you heard of anything that other sills are doing?
Well, the transportation thing I mentioned earlier, I think is one that I think has a lot of potential. Again, working with your State Department of Transportation as a funding source, I think that's a good one. I also think that, you know, there's a lot of buzz going around now today with this whole contracting with community-based organizations, how healthcare organizations or accountable healthcare organizations are now being required, you know, by, and it's, you know, I think this is an outgrowth of what originally was the Affordable Care Act, but to contract with community-based organizations. And if you've been following what the Administration of Community Living offered these grants to NASHWID and N4A to work with Area Agency on Aging or other aging organizations and Centers for Independent Living in developing some competency around developing fee-for-service contracts that could work with these medical entities. I think that's an area where bills really should explore, and we haven't figured it out exactly yet. You know, we've been doing an outreach to the rehabilitation hospitals in Phoenix for a long, long time, where we have a staff person that goes in and, you know, visits with patients at the bedside or in the rehab center on a requested basis. And, you know, does basically do an INR and peer support and, you know, kind of the peer counseling, family peer counseling, you know, right at the bedside, you know, distributes information about our centers. And that program, and I think there could be a way to bundle more services into that, could be a viable fee-for-service avenue for not, you know, certainly for urban centers, but also for rural communities that have, you know, you have local community hospitals that have, you know, have people with disabilities and that are experiencing disability and illness for the first time and are going to be challenged as they transition back out into the community and managing their healthcare needs. I think that's an avenue that we need to figure out how to do it, where we're maybe bundling some service coordination in there. You know, maybe there's some transportation piece to it. There may be some technology, assistive technology piece to it. There could be some housing piece to it, and you know we kind of need to figure out how we would bundle it and price it, and then convince hospitals or healthcare entities that we can you know lower their costs, reduce readmissions and things like that. So I think that's an area that has potential, and you know, and maybe some of you are working on that. I'd love to hear if there's any of you that are working on it, I know some of you are trying to work to develop contracts with the managed care organizations in your communities. I think, you know, that would be good if any of you have anything to share about that, because I think that's an area for the future for centers to pursue some additional funding sources. So that's kind of where I was thinking. I don't know if we have Dennis back yet.
I'm back. I fell off somewhere, and I realized I was talking to myself, which I do often anyway. So, I have one I could offer, too, that we've had some success with off and on over the years, and you know, we're closer to being that rural state where those questions, you know, what do you do if you're a rural center? And I think it comes down to really what SILs do well. And I think as Centers for Independent Living, wherever we're located, we know our communities, whether it's a local town or county or section of a state or anything like that. We really know what's out there, not just what the consumer need is, but what businesses exist. And often because of that rural nature, or small nature, we tend to have easier access to the people who are operating those businesses, because I think rural states tend just to be more, everybody seems to know everybody. One of the things we had success with here in that way is that the city of Portland, for some reason, here in Maine, is a mecca for disability insurance businesses. And it seems like there's a new one every year cropping up, and there's almost one on every block in Portland. And understand that Portland is not a large city. It's not the largest city in the state, and the population, I think, is still not 70,000. So it's small, and you can get to know people and businesses and the people in those businesses. And over the years, we built a great relationship with one company in particular, which was Union Mutual, later became Unum, later merged with Provident, and then after the merger, that spawned several other disability insurance companies that people created when they were laid off from the merger of the two. Anyway, to make a long story short, over the course of about 15 years, we actually had contractual relationships with three of these companies at one time or another. And it fit with us like a glove, because what we were able to offer to them essentially were the core services of peer support and skills instruction and information and referral with a little advocacy mixed in. And they didn't even realize that we were doing that with them. But what we did was, you know, we first had relationships with these people. They knew the successes we had working with people with disabilities in Maine and helping people either reestablish life after a disability or just deal with ongoing disability issues. And they valued what we did. And then we started talking about how we could work with them in their job of managing disability claims, both short-term and long-term disability. And honestly speaking, you have to know who you're working with, and we knew that most of these companies, their primary interest is getting someone off of a claim so they can move on and reap the rewards and benefits of keeping the money they've reserved. But at the same time, they were starting to listen to us about the value of people having a life and returning to a life of productivity through work, etc. And we were able to convince them that we know how to take a look at someone's life along with that individual and sort of develop a blueprint of how they might get back toward the goals that they have in their life. And we explained how we did that, which is simply through a conversation across the kitchen table in that person's home, getting to know them, asking them to tell us what's going on in their life, what's preventing them from, you know, meeting their goals or reaching their goals, what would help them get to those goals, what are their aspirations and dreams, and a whole range of things to really explore what's going on, not only with, say, home access, but community access and many, many other things, health, recreation, etc. So, you know, one of the first things that was interesting was way back when, I think it was in the 90s, working with Unum, they actually came to us and wanted to buy Alpha One. They valued us so much. And I remember I was not the director then, and the founder, Steve Tremblay, thought it was a wonderful offer, and he, right from the very first minute, he said, well, absolutely not. I said, you know, we can't do that, and we're not interested in doing that. However, it was fantastic for a private company that served how many clients and people around the country and outside the country would be interested in a little old sill from Portland, Maine area. But what they saw in that was something of value. They liked our belief that people could work no matter what their disability was, and our belief and steadfastness in helping people reach those goals. And they started to understand those core services, especially the peer support value. So once they were declined, we didn't want to sell out for them or become part of them. They asked us to help them build their own component internally to do that, which they eventually did. They had what they called services for independent living as one of their benefits to people who received the short-term and long-term disability services. We were actually part of the team of helping them hire people with disabilities to provide those jobs, fulfill those jobs, and to manage that department. So we had a great impact on that organization. Later, we worked with another long-term disability organization that wanted to get involved after the Tickets to Work Act was passed back around 2000. And they were looking to become an employment network, and they, again, wanted to use us as a connection to people with disabilities, which we did. We actually engaged and hired some consumers to work for us who wanted to go back to work and used them as peers to work with people through that other organization. And then lastly, a third organization, when they also, through the relationship building, learned about how we work with consumers to look at their goals and objectives and how they want to proceed with their independent living. And we did that across from the kitchen table. They essentially said, well, see, could you do that in other states? Could you do that by telephone? And I thought about it a minute, and I said, well, sure, why not? Because I didn't see why we couldn't do it. And then, of course, once we agreed to do it, I had to go back and convince staff we could do it. Because many of them were saying, well, gee, I really need to be across the kitchen table. I need to see that person's home. I really need to see the environment. And they went on and on about various things like that that were barriers to that. But I had the perfect comeback because we had two employees who actually were the best at doing these visits and generating these reports that came out of them. Were both blind and couldn't see that home environment, and yet they knew the right questions to ask and how to communicate with those individuals. So once I shared that with everybody, I said, well, you know, if these two people can do it, everybody can do it. You know, just have to look at doing it a little bit differently. And then, you know, we generated a contract. We were paid an hourly rate for the support and the contacts that people had, and we were very successful in helping this particular disability insurer move people off of claim, but more importantly, back to work and back to living in the community, to the point where this we were able to persuade them to pay for things in order to make that happen. So while they might be able to take money out of reserves and put it back under the profit line, they were making investments that enabled people to do that. And some examples of some of those investments were buying out a lease on a vehicle that an individual couldn't drive anymore because of their disability, and then purchasing a vehicle and the adaptive equipment that would allow them to drive and commute to work. Another was to help people somewhat, or to help an individual get the adaptive equipment for computer work so that they could work from home and eventually get back to the office once the office was made accessible. So we had a lot of success with those things, too. There are also three examples of fee-for-service programs that had a, I wouldn't say short life, but not a long, long life, because when management changed at these businesses, then if something wasn't the new manager's idea, it wasn't always a priority. But I think that it was still worth doing, and it still made a difference in people's lives. So And that, again, came from our ability to know the larger businesses in the area and the people who actually operated those businesses, led those businesses. But I think lots of things are possible, whether it's a rural area or an urban area. It all comes back to building the relationships that are so key to moving those things forward. I'm going to take a deep breath.
Yep, and that was really good, Dennis. And I, you know, I think a couple of things that come to my mind about that is that, you know, as an executive director, you don't have all the answers on how to, you know, bring in new sources of revenue and funding, and sometimes we as executive directors really need to, you know, rely upon our people, our staff, our program managers, our, some of us might say, well, I don't even have a program manager. I'm like managing it all, which is true. I get it. I understand that. Some of you, though, may have a little bit more horsepower than that. But I think we have to empower our people, our staff. And oftentimes we have staff that have real creative ideas and have aptitudes and their brains think in ways that are revenue generating and have and I just say that just to encourage you as executive directors, those of you who are on the phone as executive directors, to, you know, empower those people, because they'll lead to better and greater things and more you know, diversification of funding for your organization. I'll give you a quick example of that. When I first started here as the executive director back in April 2000, I had an operational person that was always mad about this one program manager that was developing these little piddly contracts. It was $1,000 here and $1,000 there, and she hated the fact that, you know, it was too hard for accounting to deal with, and we just, it didn't do enough. It wasn't, you know, it just wasn't adding enough to the bottom line, at least in this person's mind, about, you know, how it was generating revenue. But I, you know, that, well, the person that was generating these little so-called piddly contracts has now been with the organization for 28 years and has actually, you know, generated, you know, some grant-funded relationships that are, you know, worth hundreds of thousands of dollars today. That operational person who was always kind of bashing it isn't here any longer and hasn't been here for a long time. So I just give you that little example that, because I've seen other center directors that get so, you know, they get a little too control freakish. They just can't let go. They can't empower their staff. They want to make all the decisions. They want to control every little aspect. And that's impossible. And it's not healthy. And it's not, you're not going to have a culture within the organization that is going to be designed to grow and build programs. So I throw that out. And I, you know, there's a lot of things to think about when you're developing, you know, fee-for-service programs or grant-funded programs or any other sources of revenue. You know, you've got to develop budgets, and you may have to get a bank line of credit. You got to manage the cash flow. You may have to, you know, you have things like liability insurance, and you might need access to legal counsel. And you got to have competent finance, accounting, payroll, billing people. Oftentimes, when you first start out. That might be barely one person that you're relying upon to do those things. But they have to be competent. And as you grow, you probably will need to add even more competent people, because typically you're not going to be able to afford, you know, the most highly skilled people in accounting and finance in the beginning stages of program development. But as you grow, you're going to have to bring on more sophisticated people. Not to mention, you know, computer software applications and your accounting and general ledger kinds of things. So more things to think about.
Actually, if you don't mind me interrupting for just a moment, I think that goes along really well with another question we've got in the chat room.
Okay.
And I just wanted to throw out there one more time, folks, if you've got questions on the line, if you press *2, it'll raise your hand. If you're having trouble doing that, or if you are pressing *2, I'm not seeing it. If somebody could email me if you are doing it and it's not working, that'd be great. But while I'm getting that fixed, I'm going to go to the chat room. And along those lines, you guys were talking about getting competent people on board, and Kiki's asking, does anybody on the line, or do you guys have any suggestions on how do you really get your board engaged in this process?
I'll start with this, and then Dennis can jump in. That's a really good question. And when you're small, I think you may have a greater opportunity to get your board involved, because you have so few paid staff resources that you may need to lean on board members to maybe volunteer some of their expertise and skill. And, well, I mean, the hope is that you have board members that have expertise and skill. If you don't, you better go out and find them. Whether they've got, management experience or finance experience or accounting experience. I think what you'll find, though, in those early stages of, you know, when you're trying to grow a little bit, those board members, they're begging for something to sink their teeth into and help. I think you just need to ask them. Hopefully they are asking the kinds of questions that will lead them to want to jump in and get their fingers dirty in a project or developing a program. When you get as big as what we've got at Ability 360, then it becomes a little lesser of a, sometimes it's a lesser of a desire for board members to get in there too much, because then it's, you've got other issues and concerns. But I do think for a smaller center, it really can be valuable. So.
Yeah, this is Dennis. I would just add that it's incredibly important to work on board development constantly to make sure that you've got a balance there. When I first joined Alpha One, I think it was primarily a consumer board, and they were all great people, and they used various programs of the center, and they understood the programs, they valued them, they valued Alpha One, but most of them didn't have any real business experience in operating the business. They would do anything they could to help out, and most of them were peers in our peer program. But when it came to needing business acumen and things like that, you know, it really sent a signal that we needed to do some more board development and really diversify the board. I mean, that's another way of diversifying the organization, is having that balance between consumers and other people with disabilities who may actually have business experience, own their own business, et cetera, that they can offer some of those nuts and bolts things when you're a small organization that otherwise you're going to have to pay for it when you go out, and it's another use of resources that you don't necessarily have to expend if you've got that board expertise. So a lot of ways to do that, and it's a lot of work, and I think that one of the major pieces of work for an executive director is that board development piece. Jumping into developing other programs, you really need to have those resources to do it. You know, maybe even recruiting a good grant writer to the board would be useful. Have a disability, all the better. Pretty challenging in remote and rural areas, though, I know. And a lot of
Dennis, if I can add, this is Mary. I'm stealing this from one of our mentors from the April Mentoring Program, and she actually has each of her board members fill out a form that's called Who Do You Know? Because, you know, one thing when you're doing even fundraising or diversifying funding is that she said a lot of times your board members might have connections to people who maybe sit on the board of a foundation or, you know, but you just don't know that. And so she asks them, you know, who do you know who could maybe help with funding? Who do you know who might be a good person to donate, you know, services or time? Because funding also doesn't always look like money. It might also look like goods and services that you have to pay for. So that's one way that she engages her board. I just thought I'd throw that in there.
Oh, that's really great. That's a great idea. It is a way to continue to make those connections with your community.
Mm-hmm. I do have a couple more questions from the line, if you guys, you know, if this is a good time.
Yep.
Yeah.
Great. All right. Go ahead, your mic is live.
Yes, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, great. Am I on the line?
Yes. You are. Go ahead with your question or your thought.
Hey, thank you very much. It's a great discussion. Thank you to the presenters and to April for organizing. I have a question around this federal regulation called program income, and I'm wondering if are your fee-generating programs all self-sufficient, or do you have any fee-for-service that is supported by federal funds? And if you do have any that are supported by federal funds, or perhaps you had it in the beginning of the program developing, how do you deal with this federal regulation on program income? Thank you.
That's a good question.
Well, you got the answer, Dennis. You go ahead.
Well, I don't have a great answer. I could just say that over the years, we've been able to develop fee-based programs without using those federal resources we get from Part C funding. So, and I understand the complication there is, you know, how do you get that funding if you only have the Part C resources? But I think that's where it goes to. The grant writing aspect, we've used grants as demonstration grants to try things out first, and then we've looked for other resources to initiate new programming, and so we haven't had to use those federal resources in order to do so. And it also goes back, you know, we started with our federal resources back in 1979, so that goes back a long way before some of these rules were very clear or even in place, and they've changed over time. So, I know that is a concern, and even one we've had discussions about in the last couple of years with our controller, because he doesn't leave any stone unturned in terms of what needs to be complied with, and which is good. That's the kind of sharp person you need. So, it hasn't been a problem for us, but I can see where it could be difficult for a smaller or newer center that's trying to get off the ground. I guess it's donations, it's looking for other ways to start things, using the grant funding. We actually were able to persuade a business many years ago that provided the startup funds for the DME for-profit company. So there are ways to do it, but it's a lot of work.
Yeah. So you've got I think that's a good answer. You know, and for us, we've been at it for so long that we used our surplus dollars from our PAS program for the most part to, you know, help us launch some of our other kinds of fee-for-service programs. Like, as an example, you know, we've been an employment network under the Ticket to Work and Work Incentives Improvement Act since about it started, you know, in 2000. And so we've been operating an employment network. And it's basically a fee-for-service kind of program, you know, through the milestone outcome payment system. And, you know, we generate, you know, it's close to $500,000 a year with that program. I know the Ticket to Work is not one of those programs that a lot of centers have been in love with over the years. And it's certainly not a cash cow or anything like that. But it is one of those programs that, you know, puts you in the game of offering employment services to people with disabilities. And that's really mission-based for us, so that's why we've committed to it. But we've also developed some fee-for-service contracts with our other employment providers in the community to service TANF participants with employment services. And that's also been another, you know, part of the, you know, mixing in our diversifying some of our funds, but also adding to our employment offerings. The whole idea of, you know, how you can use your Part C funds and for program development, you know, it's probably a bigger issue for smaller centers than it is for us at this point. We haven't had an issue with it from an accounting perspective.
I've got some more for you. We're just kicking it up.
Go
to the line, and then I have one more in the chat room, if that's all right.
Yep.
All right, go ahead and please.
Oh, so this is me. If I can just sort of add something to the last response in terms of the grant requirements for how do you do this and not get sort of dinged for your fee for service on your grant. Here in Blue Water, and then I was in North Carolina before, so that the key is most of the things that you're going to provide for services are things you could provide under your Part C grant, right? Structured in a certain way. The key is to tell the people you're providing them to that this is a 1-year, you know, introductory offer, right? And that if this works, you know, here's going to be the fee structure next year, and here's what you get. Here's how we're going to measure it. So have that in the packet, right? Have that in the works when you start it, and so it's not a shock. So they don't have to choose to cut you off, so to speak. And they can also be then your partner in terms of how do we raise local funds to pay for this, right? And that's been a fairly successful tactic for our center. Then secondly, one of the key diversification things that has helped us with that and fee-for-service as well is to not get stuck in the we're only going to serve people with disabilities with this program right from the very start, right? So we have, for instance, a GED PrEP program. And, you know, we use the acronym WOW, with or without disability. And we can get money from, for instance, our workforce development folks under the WIOA to run that program, because they run that program for everyone, right? And we can do that for people with disabilities and not. And so if we don't have enough money under the WIOA workforce development program, we can do those same things with our Part C funds. And the only difference needs to be to designate the disability. And quite frankly, the people participating in the program, they could care less, right? They get the same service. And then, you know, if you do a pretty good job of that, actually, quote-unquote, non-disability programs, non-Part C money, will usually, you know, pay for a lot of that. And that's, as long as you have to have a good accountant, right? You have to have a good accountant, and you have to keep good, payroll time records. But it's not that hard. And in fact, I've found that communities are very accepting, to programs like that, far more than I think some of the CILs believe. And we don't lose our core, idea that is the people with disabilities end up as participants in the community that way, right? So we don't have to segregate to integrate, so to speak, and that's been something very successful to us. The other thing that I would suggest in terms of diversification that either I didn't hear or haven't heard yet is that I heard that some really good suggestions in terms of board participation, but I've been really successful, or I should say, and in this case, I've been very successful in terms of just not getting stuck in the traditional sort of frames of what's resource development, right? Because diversification means doing things differently than you might ordinarily traditionally do. And so, you know, I use improv techniques at our center, not only with our board, but with our staff, and say, you know, here's a situation, you know, let's start with ideas. And what happens is we sometimes don't solve that situation. However, we come up with six ideas on how to provide something else. And how to do so with maybe four different funding streams, and we run it as an experiment. Run a lot of pilot projects, right? I think one of the keys to being able to diversify funding is to understand you have to be willing to run experiments. I guess maybe that's what I'll add to that. And then, but I've heard a lot of good things so far. So thank you. I'll hop off.
Well, I appreciate that comment. That was really good. I like the idea of thinking outside the box that, you know, you can serve people with and without disabilities. A good example of that here that we do is our sports and fitness center. Our sports and fitness center is fully integrated. People with and without disabilities can join. There's a membership fee. We tell anybody that comes to us that says, hey, I don't have a disability, can I join them? Can I become a member here? And we're like, well, it's our mission to serve folks with disabilities, but anybody can join, absolutely. So I think that's a great way, and, you know, we're generating probably $200,000 a year in membership revenue. And we don't turn anybody away, of course, if, you know,
right,
folks
right.
afford to pay, but yeah, I think that's a great idea, great suggestion.
Great. I just have one more question for y'all. We're going to move back in time a little bit. Amy is wondering, Dennis, what did you mean by disability insurance? Were you referring to workman's comp carriers? Insurers in her area don't want to pay us for IL services because they say we have to provide them for free. Have you combated with that, or how have you combated that? I think we stumped Dennis.
Yeah. Dan, is he there? Or are you on mute? I'm not sure what happened to Dennis. I don't know exactly how he'd respond to that question.
Well, Amy, we will get that question to Dennis if he doesn't pop back in, and we'll get an answer for you. I also just wanted to throw out there, this is Mary talking, not the chat room, but, I know that some of the folks in the rural areas were talking about what are some ideas that you have, and I know a lot of rural centers who have had some real success in doing fee-for-service around the pre-ups, youth services. And so, especially in rural areas, I think with the limited options to CRP or to other, agencies who can provide, like, the soft skill training or the self-advocacy training, I know that centers have really been able to step up in rural areas and do that and then receive fees for their services since, pre-ex, they're mandated to spend about 15% of their funding on that, and so there is money to spend. That was a callback to a question from earlier, but I wanted to throw that out there.
I was just going to say, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I do think that's an area that centers really have an opportunity to step up and do more. We just established a RIS contract with our vocational rehabilitation program, the Rehab Instructional Services, to offer the work incentives to youth in transition, DB 101, and that kind of in transition services. And yeah, we know because of WIOA how VR has to spend X 15% of their funding on those kind of services. So I think, developing those relationships, if you're not developing those relationships with your VR agency, you need to do that. And I know we've got a big WIPA. We've been a WIPA grantee for a long time. And I know my staff have been very assertive in working that relationship over the past year and a half or so. I'm glad you brought that up, because I know we hadn't talked about that yet today.
I know that I think we have Dennis back now, too.
Yeah, I couldn't hear you for a while. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think that the question was about what is a disability insurer, and it's not a workers' comp insurance. It's actually if someone's injured on the job and they have disability insurance, then it's going to be income replacement. And, the disability insurer will insure you often for a short term, and then after a period of time, then you become a long-term claimant. And it's at that point where they are required to set aside that income replacement money for you over a period of time. And many of us have that through our employment, maybe not everybody, but it's a typical benefit that's offered in many companies that people have either the short-term or long-term disability insurance. And it's far different than the workers' comp insurance. I don't know if that helps or not.
Thank you. Well, at this time, we don't have any more questions in the queue. If you guys had other information you wanted to share, and again, if folks do want to share, we'd love to hear what you're doing in your center. So please press *2, and we can make you live. And Dennis, sorry, one thing quick. The second part of that question was that insurers in their area say that IL services have to be provided for free so that they won't pay for it. Is that something you ever had to deal with?
It is something we've dealt with quite a bit. And I remember when I first joined Alpha One back in the mid-90s, and I wasn't director then, there were about three of us there as staff people who did a lot of interaction with organizations that were looking for things, and often that was their response. Well, we thought you guys were a nonprofit and did everything for nothing. And there were some things we would do for so-called nothing, which were the core services. But, you know, we would explain, you know, there is nothing that's free. Everything costs money and happens to be covered by other resources. But if they were looking for something above and beyond those core services, then if they wanted it for nothing, we would simply say, well, no, there actually is a fee for that. And we had an internal competition to see who could get the most for our services, because we had firm belief that, you know, the knowledge we have as an organization is valuable, and the people out there who don't have that information should pay a fair price for it. Now, I'm not saying consumers should pay for it, but I'm saying that other businesses who are looking for something, you know, just like they charge something for what they offer, they ought to understand that even a nonprofit has to pay the right bill and other bills in order to stay open. So we actually had a fun competition in terms of who could actually get people to agree to pay after a good discussion around those things, and it kind of raised morale as we were able to have greater success with it. So I think you look at different ways to make things work, and but we were always willing, if someone wanted something for nothing, to say, sorry, we can't do that, and not give in and do it for nothing.
Great.
George?
Yes, thank you, Dennis. Right. So, again, you know, we have time for a couple of other comments. If there's one, you can press star 2. But if not, I'll turn it back over to our speakers.
And if there's a question, you can take it. I was going to throw out one other kind of thing that my staff have done over the years that has brought in some additional revenue, but has also kind of connected us to our community, that I think has been, you know, really positive. And we've, again, I don't think every community can, maybe, I don't know how you do these in smaller communities or versus the larger communities, so again, it's resource based, but we've hosted a health and wellness fair. We've hosted a technology fair. We've done an African American Disability Summit. We do an American Indian Disability Summit. And we're now in the second year of doing a Latino Disability Summit. And, you know, the kind of the cool thing about those is, again, I've got certain staff that just really like doing those, coordinating those kind of events, and the corporate sponsors really step up and help fund it. And usually, you know, it's been so successful that we've actually, you know, they turn a little bit of a profit. I know the P word, we're not supposed to use the P word, but they do. And so they generate a little surplus. They're not cash cows or anything like that, but they do create some really goodwill in the community and in connection to the disability community. So those are some other kinds of programming things you can think about that, you know, can, again, connect you to the corporate world, but also generate a little bit of revenue and the disability and connect you to the disability community.
Great. Thank you. If you have one more comment,
Hi, this is Tony. I'm a director for Center for Independent Living in Florida, and I just wanted to find out if you all have experience in collaborating with post-secondary institutions on grant writing efforts to obtain funding for SIL services and efforts, and or with the VA on currently, you know, any university community. There seems to be a lot of interest from faculty there to want to collaborate on grant efforts, ranging from doing needs assessments to researching the efficacy of programs, And these are also in line with some of the interests the VA has. And I know the VA is undergoing some changes and looking to develop more institutional partnerships outside of the VA in order to provide services for veterans. So I guess I'm basically just asking, what are your thoughts and or experiences in partnering with post-secondary institutions on grant writing and with the VA?
I think it's a really good idea. Go ahead, Dennis.
Well, I was just going to say the same thing. I think it's a great idea. Anytime you get a chance to partner with somebody and find some energy, I would think, why would you not do that? So, good for you for doing that. In terms of the VA, you know, we've had no success here in Maine really working with the VA, not for lack of trying, but they're a difficult system to work with here, and I've heard elsewhere as well, but I love the idea of working with academia and finding a way to expand resources that way.
Yeah, and I echo the VA comment, although we've had a lot of success at bringing veterans into our sports and fitness center. We have nearly 800 veterans that are now members of our sports and fitness center, which is really cool. And we do have a small VA contract, but they are a tough nut to crack. Just because of the way that system works. But I think developing the relationships with the post-secondary education programs, I think makes a lot of sense. We're doing it not so much to partner on grant writing or needs assessment or that sort of thing, which I think is really smart. We've done it with Arizona State University's School of Journalism to bring in journalism students to work with our marketing department to develop some of our marketing materials and write articles that we publish in our magazine, that we publish on our website, that we push out to the local media, newspapers, and such. So we've got a great relationship with the School of Journalism. Again, it's not generating funds necessarily, but it's giving us free, marketing talent and journalism talent.
And we've worked with three universities or colleges up here that have occupational therapy programs, and we've been able to get each of them to jump on board with access surveys of local communities after teaching the students all the things they need to look for, and it gets coaching around how to go out and interact with businesses so that they're not a threat, but get out the measurement tapes or various things like that to really do a local access report that can then be shared with businesses and others to try to move along that agenda. So, and it's usually also a good way to educate those future healthcare providers more about living with a disability when they start to see some of those barriers that exist in the community.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're getting close to the top of time here. I do have one more comment. Hopefully, for some reason, it's not letting me unmute. Really, are you there? I apologize. Kimberly, if you've got a question, you're welcome to email it to me or thought. If not, I know that we are getting again to the top of the time, and I appreciate everybody. Again, please remember to evaluate our conversation, and I just want to give a big warm thank you to Dennis and Phil, and I appreciate you guys leading this really important topic. Try one more time, but yeah, for some reason, Kimberly, your line does not want to unmute.
Have her send the question, and we can respond offline.
That's a great thought. So, Kimberly, please let me know if you've got questions. We can get an answer. If not, if you've got something to add to the conversation, we would love to add it up on the website for the page. And again, I know that Dennis and Phil had said that they had some, you know, materials. If folks wanted to get in touch with them, we will make their information live up on the website, if that's all right with you guys.
Absolutely.
Great. All right. Well, again, thank you, everybody, and I hope that you guys have a great beginning of summer. It's June tomorrow. So with that, please join us next month. We actually have our youth topical call part of the series, and it's going to be on fee-for-service in youth programs, and they're going to be talking a lot about voc rehab in that area, so it'll go nicely with this one. So please join us for that. Oh, and actually, so Kimberly's question, I know that we're out of time, but is wondering how the gentleman suggests we help to influence our local VRs in working with Phil. Can we answer that in a couple minutes, or is that a whole new topic?
Well, it just say something briefly for sure. We've over historically have had a very good relationship with vocational rehab, although we've had ups and downs in the 2000s, but prior to that, they might have been the most instrumental state office in helping us advance the independent living agenda here in the state, including the creation of personal assistance services and, you know, a couple of other programs. So I think that, you know, for us, I think there's a benefit to being in a small rural state because everyone has to really work together or things really fall apart usually. And there's a lot more communication and interconnection about with people. So, I mean, to me, it was a breath of fresh air when I moved to Maine and found that you could pretty much talk to anybody, including the governor of the state, which never would have happened when I was in Massachusetts prior to that. So I think we've been fortunate here with a good relationship with vocational rehab.
Yeah, and I would say that similarly, you know, we've had our ups and downs with them over the years, too. I think because we have the WIPA grant, the Work Incentives grant, that they really value us because of that, because, you know, we're serving their consumers as much as, you know, we're serving the entire disability community that's looking for that kind of information. But I think that is a big help. But I think now, because of the changes with WIOA, that they know that they can benefit from relationships with SILS more than maybe they valued in the past. So I set up those meetings and go talk to their leadership and try to, again, you know, reinvigorate that relationship.
Thank you. You know, and I just wanted to add with that I think that it takes a whole team. You know, everyone from the SILC needs to be working with your VR leadership at the state level to, you know, individual agencies, you know, working with them. And I get it can be really frustrating. You know, if VR is not working with you, one thing that I have always recommended to folks is that maybe it's the VR in your local area that isn't playing nice, because those individual offices do tend to act a little bit differently. And so if you've got somebody else, you know, at a different office of the state that's doing a really good job, you know, maybe see if you can get them to help spread the message, because, you know, that peer support is so valuable from VR to VR. That's my throw-in. But I know it's frustrating, and we are over time now, and so we will let you all go. And I really appreciate, again, thank you so much, Phil and Dennis, for taking your time out to work with us today. I think it was a success.
Great. Well, we were glad to be with everybody.
Great. Absolutely. All right. Well, we will talk again soon. Thanks, everyone.